and is skybound with a talking Joe Gus. Everyone calm down, we're here to talk comics, and it's skybound with the talking Joe Gus. Everyone calm down, we're here to talk comics, skybound.
Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe. Today we will be talking about the Energon Universe 2024 special, which just came out as a free comic book day issue and also as a standalone standard issue with lots of interesting variant covers. But I will not be talking about this alone. We will be joined by artist Jason Howard, and helping me to talk to him will be Tim Finn.
Hello, Mark, and hello, listeners and viewers. Let's bring in our guest.
Here we go. It's Jason, and I'll do my quick blurb. Jason Howard is a comic book artist, illustrator, and designer, best known as the artist and co-creator with Robert Kirkman on the Image comic series Super Dinosaur and The Astounding Wolfman, plus The Trees and Cemetery Beach with Warren Ellis. He also is known for his own book, Big Girls, and more besides. He's been doing character spotlight covers for the Energon Universe second printing covers, but most importantly, and the reason why he's here today, is he did the G.I. Joe story in the Energon Universe special, released at time of recording just yesterday for Free Comic Book Day, May the 4th, 2024. Welcome, Jason.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Tim. Appreciate you guys having me on.
Thank you so much for joining. And it feels like we're very in the moment with the issue literally coming into my hands yesterday, and also very futuristic because Jason is trialing some hands-free technology driving at the same time as talking to us.
It's called having my wife drive while I do a podcast.
Very good. Futuristic. So whereabouts on the planet Earth are you joining us today?
I'm in Michigan, so you'll be seeing the lovely trees of springtime Michigan maybe through the car window as we drive. So it's actually really nice. This is a good time of year to be in Michigan. The winters are, you know, if you like snow and cold, they're good. If you don't, they're, you know, not as good. But summers are great.
Very good. Let's start with where we often do, which is what does G.I. Joe mean to you? So when was the first time that you encountered the G.I. Joe property?
It was the original cartoon series. I don't know how old exactly I was, but it was a very prime, like I was the age, the show was on TV and I was watching it. One of my kind of earliest memories with G.I. Joe was I hadn't had enough or the level of exposure to media that you get as you get older. So there was an episode where I think Snake Eyes at the end of the episode died. And I thought he was dead for real. And, you know, you're like, that's the best guy on the show and he's dead. And I remember talking to friends at school about it the next day. And then that episode that afternoon turns out, oh, he wasn't dead. He escaped. And I don't remember the rest of the story, but that was a very vivid moment, that sort of cliffhanger ending that you haven't experienced enough then to know, oh, that's sort of a storytelling trick. The main guy probably isn't really dead. But yeah, I read it, and then I remember the commercials they would do for the comics. They would run them during mm-hmm. the cartoon show. And so, like, there was a commercial where Serpentor made an appearance, and it was in the comics, and I remember that very vividly as well.
Excellent. So it sounds like primarily sort of discovering about G.I. Joe through the cartoons. Did you get an opportunity to pick up the comics or the toys at the same time?
So, yeah, I had tons of figures, lots of vehicles. I never had the big, big vehicles. My parents, you know, were a little more, well, you know, if it's your birthday or Christmas, fine, but outside of that, you have to use your own money for toys. So I was always a little judicious about, all right, how much do I want to spend? What do I get? I remember buying the Storm Shadow figure at a Kmart when those were still around. And my dad was like, don't open it in the car. You know, wait till you get home. Well, I couldn't wait, so I popped it open, and it, like, sprung, and his swords went flying, and I never found his swords, and I was just devastated because, you know, the coolest part of Storm Shadow is the swords, and I never had Storm Shadow swords. So anytime he was fighting, he had to borrow somebody's weapon.
And there were no swords released in any accessory packs.
I don't know if they were or weren't. I never bought any extra stuff. It was always whatever came with another figure, Storm Shadow would use their weapon or borrow their weapon.
Right.
And then I would occasionally pick up the comics, but I had access. My parents worked near a used bookstore, and I would often stop in there. So I would find comics in, like, you know, dime boxes at the time and dig through, and I would just buy random whatever I thought looked cool. And so there would occasionally be a G.I. Joe comic in there that I would pick up, but I didn't follow the comic storyline regularly. It was, if a cover looked cool, I might grab it.
Did you have a comic book store near you? Did you buy new comics off of newsstands?
Not until after high school. So at that age, I was not buying comics. I didn't know a comic store existed. I would get comics from this used bookstore, and I was buying a Spider-Man comic, and randomly one week I bought another Spider-Man comic, and I realized they were continued, like the numbers were sequential. And that was like my first realization that, oh, all these stories didn't just end in a weird way. They're meant to continue from issue to issue. And, you know, which is very obvious, but at the time nobody explained it to me. I was a little kid, you know, and I learned to read young. So I was, I don't know how old when I was, you know, buying these books, but fairly young. And so that was when I realized, oh, I should try to track down the numbers on the front in order, because then it would be one big story. And how awesome is that?
The logic of the sequential numbering of comics, it is obvious. It's not as obvious as one might think. If you talk to people who have never read comics, or if we go back, you know, 20 years before comics sort of made a bigger impact in culture, you know, someone who's reading like Time or Newsweek, they don't refer to the issue number because there is no issue number. They just refer to the date. It's like, oh, do you have the March Rolling Stone? Do you have the April Rolling Stone? Do you have the new Rolling Stone? And just yesterday at my comic book store, a dad was buying some comics for his kid. I think this was their third visit ever. The third time his kid, maybe 10 years old, had ever got comics. And the dad pointed to some back issues and he said, what are these variants? What's a variant? Mm-hmm. And then he was pulling up back issues and it was like an Avengers from the 70s. And he's like, is this the number? This is the number of the issue? And so what you just described, I was seeing this is yesterday in 2024. Yep. This was happening.
And I feel like when graphic novels started to become more mainstream the last 15 or so years, or I don't know what the date, but publishers did start getting a little smarter with big numbers, like this is number one, this is number two. Not all of them, but I feel like I see that more on things that are intended to be a little more mainstreamy to make it easier for people, especially if it's a book that has a definitive start point, like say, you know, Astounding Wolfman has a really big number one on volume one, so somebody knows, oh, that's where I start.
And was there a light bulb moment where you realized that these comics that you've been, you know, picking up here and there are created by actual people? And hold on, this might be something that I'd be interested in doing at some point as a career.
Yeah, there definitely was. So I had sort of stopped picking up comics from the used bookstore, and I was buying books from the used bookstore, as it felt like there's a lot more like story content in them. But I still liked comics, and I was drawing all the time, and I would occasionally see books and just pick them up and flip through and see if it was interesting. And I was in high school when Todd McFarlane's Spider-Man was coming out, and I ran, again, randomly, I was at a store with my mom, and she was checking out, and I was standing by the spinner rack. I was like, oh, that cover looks really awesome. I picked it up, and the inside, I was like, man, the inside looks as awesome as the cover, you know, which isn't always the case in comics. So I picked it up, and I just obsessed over that comic because I was like, this is like everything I'm drawing, and it's in a comic, and the whole comic looks that way. Who is this guy who created this thing? And then from there, I started tracking down other Todd McFarlane books, and then, you know, started getting more back into comics. And it was right before the Image kind of stuff kicked off. So it was all the guys who were big at the time, Jim Lee, Rob, Todd, Eric, you know, basically everybody I was picking up comics from were the ones who went and formed Image. So then I was all on board with that stuff from the jump and had all those early issues and you know, kind of went from there. So I had decided, I you know, I'm like, I think I want to do comics. Like, it has a story component, which I really liked. I was reading a lot and writing just my own stuff at the time, not for comics, just writing. And then I loved art, and so I decided, oh, that's a good kind of combo of those things. And I guess the short version is, didn't really see, like, it's hard to see what a career path from being in high school to working in comics looks like. But I'd heard of this thing called graphic design, and my parents were very encouraging. So I went to school for graphic design and illustration at a local community college. It had a really good program at the time, and they had these things called computers and early versions of things like Photoshop and Adobe Illustrator that were very cutting edge at the time. And so I got a degree in that and then was able to start working as an entry-level designer. Well, at the time, I had started going to comic book conventions and showing around portfolios and doing sample pages and mailing them off to Marvel and DC and Valiant and Image and any small publisher. You have a whole box of rejection letters that you'd get back from everyone, you know, a form letter. And so those are fun to look at and go through.
Hmm.
Yeah, so around that time, I started going to comic book conventions, and I was reading everything I could about how to break into comics, and I would do sample pages and send them out and go to conventions and get portfolio reviews by pros, by editors, and that sort of started, you know, my journey and sort of you learn from talking to people. You know, the first couple of conventions are like, well, you can't just draw pinups if you want to draw comics. Comics are sequential storytelling. You're like, oh, what is sequential storytelling? Well, you know, and they're like, you know, the panels progress and you start realizing, oh, yeah, there's an art behind it, not beyond the art of drawing. There's the art of how to tell a story and how to choose a moment and what is that. And that I really found fascinating. Sometimes I like that part of the process more than the actual drawing of it because it's very engaging on a story level. And that's, I think, when it gets to the heart of it, that's the thing that always appealed to me about comics was the dynamic visual storytelling, that sort of combo thing that creates that magic, you know.
What, so from realizing that this was a potential career path and trying to find out more about how you'd break in, what was the big moment how to break into comics moment that actually got you into comics?
So lots of moments that seemed like big moments at the time, but the one that actually turned into things was meeting Robert Kirkman. I met him at a comic book convention, and I was pretty active at the time. I was working as a graphic designer, but still very actively wanted to make comics and was making things on my own with small publishers. And I had received a piece of advice from someone, I don't recall who, that pointed out that in comics, typically writers are around at the early stages of a project. And, you know, an editor would reach out to a writer to help develop a thing, or a writer would pitch a story to a publisher. And at some later point, the conversation would turn to, we need an artist, who would be a good artist for this, and conversations would start happening around that. So the advice was, if you want to get into comics, and I still give this advice to people as a way, meet lots of writers, you know, show them your work, say, hey, if you ever are looking for anyone, I'd love to, you know, work with you. I'm a fan of your work, if that's true. And that's, so I was pretty actively doing that. I met lots of writers and did that, you know, guys like Mark Waid, Jeff Johns, a lot of named people you would recognize who were farther along in their career. Robert at the time was early in his career. I think Invincible had just come out, and I had read a previous book he did called Super Patriot with Corey Walker, based on the Eric Larson character. So I was like, oh, this guy's a really good writer. Let me check out this new book, Invincible. It's like, oh, this is super fun. I love it. And so I met him at a convention in Chicago and showed him my work, and we exchanged information. I did a pinup for Invincible. And then at some point after that, he was doing a project called The Pact, which was a 4-issue miniseries, kind of teaming up different Image heroes, one of which was Invincible. And he was writing only one of those and needed an artist for that one, and was like, hey, you'd probably work for free or cheap. And I said, yeah, I probably would work for free or cheap, especially if we have a long enough deadline so I can fit it around the day job. And so we worked together on that, and that kind of kickstarted our relationship. And from there, we developed Astounding Wolfman. And I, not long after that, left the design job and have been comics full-time ever since. There it is.
Like Invincible and Walking Dead and a couple of others, Robert Kirkman has got this knack of creating books that run and run with the same team for a good chunk of issues, so that you know, they're very enjoyable to read and really satisfying to then read at the end of them as a, you know, as a whole piece as well. Yes. So I can't remember off the top of my head how many issues that Astounding Wolfman ran, but it was a good chunk.
I think 24 issues, I believe. Yeah, so four. I mean, it seemed long until you compare it to Invincible or Walking Dead, and then it seemed like a short run.
I feel like a question that is embedded here is, what is your sense of either the monthly grind of comics or a long-term partnership on a series? Because for a long time, comics tended to have artists who would stay on a book for 10 issues, 20 issues, right, or more. And in the last few years, in the last, say, 20 years, many artists will do 3 issues on, 3 issues off, or 6 mm-hmm. issues on, and then go somewhere else. And the expectation that you pencil 12 issues a year, that expectation is not around like it used to be. So can you talk about your sense of the monthly grind and collaborating?
Yeah. So it's very hard. I learned that very quickly, and Wolfman was never 100% monthly, just because I was penciling, inking at the beginning, I was coloring. We later brought in a colorist. But the one thing that for me struck me is when I was doing comics around my day job, I would have the whole day to sort of marinate on what was coming up, what I needed to be drawing that evening, you know. And if you're doing comics full time, you get up and I have to draw a page today, and I may not feel like it, or maybe I used up a lot of my cool ideas yesterday and this scene has continued, and now I have to come up with new ideas and new shots and make it dynamic. And then tomorrow I have to do it again. And then the next day I have to do it again. And I love it because it's fun, but it does get to a point where it's just hard. And for me, when I first started on Wolfman, there's elements of it that I really like. I was like, oh, that turned out well, even at the time. And there would be things at the time where I knew this could be better, but it's going to take me a day or 2 days to figure out how to make it better. Like, I could see it was not what I wanted it to be. And I could, from reading the script, see the potential of what it could be. But today, this page is what I'm capable of. So then you have to make a decision. Do I tomorrow work on this page more to get it to where I want it to be? Or do I do another page tomorrow because this issue needs to be out at this time? And where do you balance that? Like, what's the balance between the prettiness, I guess, of the art on this page or the whole of the story that we're trying to communicate. And so I don't know that there is a right or wrong answer to that. And sometimes I've made one decision to prioritize the story. Other times I've just not been okay and prioritized the art and trying to come up with art, either a storytelling solution or an art solution that, you know, worked better for that. So it is hard, and the guys who can do it well and do it fast have a little something extra. You know, you see guys like John Romita Jr., and it feels like, you know, especially at his peak, he was doing multiple books a month, and his storytelling is just perfect, and his drawing is very specifically him, and he just has this great comic book language that, you know, is a thing that you get a little envious of because, you know, he's able to make comics and make story, and they all look consistent, and they all look like him, and yeah. I don't know. I feel like, I don't know if that answers the question, but that's...
No. Yes, thank you. As a follow-up, many years later, either because how you draw has changed, how you mentally approach comics has evolved, or because you have other responsibilities or jobs, what is your preference for how many pages a week or how many issues a year?
That's really hard. So from an art place, my preference would be, I don't know, let me do 2 or 3 pages a week and get paid amazing for those 2 or 3, you know, because you want to put out your best work. You want to put out every page. You want people to be like, wow, this is amazing. But there's a real joy in the process, you know, when you get in the middle of a run, you know, like after a few issues of Super Dinosaur, for example, I felt like I knew what that book was. Robert and I had a very clear vision of what we were doing. I had drawn the main characters enough to be comfortable drawing them and kind of figure out what my look for them was. And then I would get the scripts from Robert. They would be a blast. I would draw them. It would be fun. And everything was kind of worked out, so you were just making cool stuff. And so that was really fun. I had that experience on Trees also. So Trees was similar, and that it was a longer run. So after the first couple issues, you know, maybe issue 4 or so, I started to really get a feel for what I wanted that book to be visually. And Warren's scripts were amazing. And I felt like I had a handle on what this book was, what it could be, what it visually was supposed to be. And so you're not really making big picture decisions then. You're like, this is what it is. And now you're kind of in the pocket. And on a shorter series or a shorter run or a fill-in issue, I did a Flash fill-in issue a year or two ago, and it was a blast, but I was like, oh, by the end, I kind of have starting to get a hang of how I want to draw the Flash, and it's done. You know, it's the last page, and it's done, and you're like, oh, all right, you know, like I'm just kind of getting the hang of it. So as a reader, I miss those long runs by artists because you get to see them evolve, but also... like I'm in the art, if the artist is kind of like an actor, I'm in this story with the same person, the same look, everybody looks how they should look. So, but I get both sides of that as a creator.
Okay. And if we skip forward to the present or maybe 2023 or so, you've had this significant impact on the Energon universe so far in terms of having these second print covers against a logo and white background, which has been something cool to see. You know, this variant covers are often very inconsistent. It's, you know, whoever the cool artist is that's doing it. So it's cool to see this unifying feature. Can you tell us about getting involved in the Energon universe? At what point did it all get on your radar?
Sure. So early on, Sean Makowitz at Skybound had asked me to do a piece of pitch art when they were looking to pitch Hasbro on the whole thing. And I didn't know a lot of details there. And so I drew some art for that. And then later, once the books were kind of established, maybe Robert and I are friends. And so we still talk regularly, but Robert or Sean had reached out and said, would you be willing to do these, you know, this second print cover for, I think it was Void Rivals was the first one. It was like, hey, we're doing a second printing and we think it'd be cool to have this kind of character showcase, you know. And it took me a minute to grasp the sort of simplicity of it. My first sketches were more typical comic book covers, you know, dynamic guys jumping with rocks and backgrounds. And Robert was like, no, like, I just want to see the dude. Like, I want him standing there looking cool, like a showcase, almost like box art, you know, for a toy. Like, mm-hmm. This is what the guy looks like, but, you know, do it in your style in a way that looks cool. And so then I did I think Jetfire was the first one for Void right. Rivals 1. And then because Void Rivals launched sooner, then there was a couple other, like, more obscure characters to me, Skuxoid and the Quintessens. And I was like, are these guys in Transformers? I don't remember them at all.
Season 3. They're in season 3.
Well, so apparently I wasn't watching the cartoon then, or my memory just was obsessed with the robots and everybody else was off to the side. And then once the other books launched, Sean was like, hey, we'd love you to keep doing those same style covers, but across the other books. And so I agreed to do, it was just a small number at first. And then as the books continue to do well, now they've expanded and they're like, just do them all. Maybe we'll get to every character at some point.
So. Are you looking forward to 5 years from now when this art shows up on wrapping paper, backpacks, a profile book, and you get you don't get paid again?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it'd be cool to see, but, you know, I know what the deal is getting into it. So
I ask this gently because there were some really wonderful artists who drew profiles for Dreamwaves Transformers, like every single character got a, you know, Marvel Universe handbook style drawing. And a lot of those still show up here and there on like, you know, not like a DVD box cover, right. But maybe the menu.
Right. There'll be Optimus on some bed sheets at some point.
Yeah.
You must be like really invested in the success of the Energon universe because it's when the second printing happens that right, you get your job.
Yeah.
And drawing a cover that has no background seems like a pretty sweet gig.
It makes that part easier.
That pitch art, is that something you remember and can describe? I assume that has not been repurposed as one of these covers.
It has not. It was actually a page, like a fake comic book page, and has some elements on it that I probably shouldn't talk about in case they become actual story elements at some point. But I was given a broad description of characters to include, and then I just sort of made up a 4 or 5 panel page of them interacting. And so it's like it was taken from the middle of a comic, there's nothing else. So I assume at some point in time, maybe some big collection will have some fun back matter for fans to see that early stuff.
Hmm. My next question simultaneously jumps back and jumps forward. I really loved Big Girls, a miniseries that was collected into a collection. And Jason, Mr. Howard.
That's right.
The spine has a 1 on the bottom of it. So as much as I want you as a big G.I. Joe fan, when are you going to draw more G.I. Joe? Why do I have to wait? When are you going to when are you going to write and draw more Big Girls, and why not?
It has a 1 for a reason. It's creator-owned books, launching a new character. It's just, it's tough in comics, and sometimes things take off right away. Sometimes they take a little while longer. Big Girls was scheduled originally to come out basically in the middle of COVID and everything that happened with that. So it got delayed and came out in the early wave of Image books after COVID. And I'm very proud of that book and that series. And there were a lot of fans. We ran ran a pretty extensive letter column. I grew up reading Savage Dragon and always loved how Eric would do just like 7 pages of letters. So we didn't get to that level, but there's a pretty extensive letter column. And so I really appreciate the fans of that book. And I've written and have a lot more mapped out in that world. The first volume was meant to stand alone, but introduce like a corner of the Big Girls universe. And then at the end, as a character kind of breaks off, we get to explore the rest of that world with her. And so, you know, I would love to get back to that at some point, but it's not on my drawing board at the moment. So that's about as evasive as I can be.
I've stuck on the screen some of the G.I. Joe related variant covers, the second print variant covers that you did and that you shared on Instagram. It's interesting to see your process, because this varies so much from artist to artist about how they get to that final piece. For you, it looks like you start very much from like a rough compositional kind of take on things. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about that process?
And we are looking at a digital sketch right now, not a sketch on paper.
Correct. Yeah, typically with these, sometimes I'll just take a pencil and tiny little figures, like I don't know if you can see my fingers, like an inch tall. We'll just doodle little stick guys of like, how does he hold a gun? Is it up? Is it down? And I look at what the character is. And like with Rock and Roll here, I'm like, all right, he's got that giant gun and the gun belt, and I want him to look a little tattered up and holding the gun like he just finished, you know, a battle. And so that was kind of in my head with him. With other characters, you know, I'll try to maybe accentuate something a little different. And then I go from that sketch, and usually we'll send 2, 3, or 4 of them to Skybound, and they'll look at them and say, we like this one or that one or none of them. And from there, I'll take the sketch. Yeah, like the Baroness, that was one of the unchosen sketches. Yeah, and then there's the one that they picked. And usually from going to sketch to final, I try to clean up things like how do hands actually work? You know, my sketch, the hand might be a bubble, but I'll try to clean up how does a hand work? What do fingers look like? You know, the anatomy aspects, while still trying to keep, a lot of times your loose sketch can have more life or movement to it. And that's always the challenge for me, is drawing it in a more appealing way, but trying to not lose any sort of bounce that may have been there in the original sketch, or ideally, you know, increasing the level of sense of movement or dynamics that, you know, maybe weren't present in the initial sketch. The early drawing stuff is digital, and then I will print that out on paper and do the finished drawing in inks traditionally, and then scan it in colors back in Photoshop on the computer.
And given the sort of the simplicity of a single figure against a white background, is it tricky to come up with a new idea for each one that is subtly different to something that you've done before?
What's a new way to hold a gun? Yeah, it, like Ripper, it's like, all right, that was fun because that weapon is so distinctive, the big Jaws of Life thing. Yeah. So immediately that informs your pose of how he's going to hold it. So all the sketches were sort of built around how he's holding that, you know, particular element or that particular weapon. And it can get a little like, have I done that pose before? What can I do to make it feel different from somebody else who may be a similar character and have a similar weapon? But sometimes when doing a traditional cover, you can sort of, the composition becomes the art element and the figure is a secondary part of the piece. With these, it's all figure, which has been really fun for me to be able to just kind of focus on, I don't have anything else to cover it up. You know, there's no smoke that's going to cover up their feet if I don't feel like drawing an element. There's no tree or shadows that are going to block them. It's all figure work, and how do I make this work and be an appealing piece? And so some of that for me has been spotting the blacks and using shadows to try to make them pop and feel kind of dynamic as just a standalone figure.
Okay, so I guess let's move on to the issue of the day, Energy on Universe Free Comic Book Day.
When did you get this assignment? And how long did you have to do it? The eight-page story, the eight-page G.I. Joe story.
I don't remember when, but it was, the deadline was shorter than I would have liked. So I think it was this year, like I think in 2024 at some point. Sean reached out and said, hey, do you want to do this? The script will be coming at some date in the future. I could look it up on the exact dates, but. And then I got it, and I had enough time to do it, but it was, you know, the time was coming, and I think maybe the colorist was a little crunched for time at the end, so apologies to Mike Spicer on that.
Okay, so you have been a G.I. Joe fan. As a kid, you watched the show and had some toys and read some comics. You are more associated with creator-owned books, and you are not very much associated with corporate comics, with long-running characters that you sort of swoop in for 6 months or 2 years. Is G.I. Joe something that had been on your list? Was this a fun opportunity? What is your sense of getting this assignment as a pro and a fan?
Yeah, it was really fun. I mean, I've always liked military, like I like drawing just basically. I like drawing tech, gear, guns, robots, all that kind of hard-edged stuff. It was always easier for me to draw, like when I was starting out, than the human character stuff took more work. I think some artists, it's opposite. They're very good with fluid figures, but they have to draw buildings, and they're like, oh, you know. And so, I know the way my brain works, I always understood mechanical things a lot easier than anatomy things. So drawing G.I. Joe stuff has always been like, oh, they got all kinds of guns and tech and weapons and vehicles. And, you know, so that's an appealing thing for me. Getting to do this story was super fun. You know, a short little action story with Baroness. Yeah, I was like, Josh Williamson wrote a great little script. And I told him when I read the script, I'm like, it's got awesome stuff and it's not so crammed that I don't have room to make the cool things look cool. I think he does a good job pacing his stories from a comic book point of view. Like, this is the story. This is what we need for plot and character content. But we need these moments. Otherwise, what's the point of doing an action-based comic that doesn't have room to showcase these action, you know, visuals?
It's only a total, I think, of 8 pages or so. But it's a definite balance of, you know, plot advancing the overall story, but then having these big action beats within that. We've got, I guess, the starting on that front page with Hawk in the office. You know, we're literally setting up the whole story in one panel, really. This is where we are. This is what's going to happen next. Let's go, kind of thing. And we're into the first action sequence. There's not too much space wasted, and you can't afford to if you've just got 8 pages, right?
Yeah, and as an artist, and I've told this to writers before, when Warren and I first started working together, I told him this. I'm like, I love drawing cool things, and I'm okay to draw a big complex thing, but the best thing is to draw it once and then move on. So if you've got a big, like, crazy city scene, you know, like this, you know, it's super fun for me to draw that and to really get into that world. But if I have to draw that over and over for multiple pages, then it starts to feel like, well, I already did that drawing, you know, last page, or yesterday I spent my day looking at this particular city to gather reference for, you know, how this stuff might look. So it's fun to do a story like this where we start at an office and then I have to draw that office again. And now we're in this cool city. And then the action starts. And then we're in another location and part of the city. And now we're on a plane. And now, so it's just like every day is some cool new thing to draw. So from an art place, that was really fun.
And where are we on page one? It looks like, I don't know, Morocco, somewhere like that. Is it a specific place?
If you look at the layout page of page one, the sketch for that page, over to the left, there's a little tag of where we're
at. Macau.
In the script, Joshua had left a little flexibility of what city. He had mentioned a couple suggestions of things. And so I started looking up reference and try to find something that felt international, but, you know, still would have some buildings and cool cars. And
I'm thinking of the illustration cues, or the script cues that are carried forward, right? It's like this very expensive sports car, and then this architecture, which doesn't feel like most of America. It feels like right. a tiny sliver of Florida, maybe a tiny sliver of California, and that's it. Presumably, Jason, you had reference for the first panel from the Duke miniseries.
Yes.
Okay, so then the new character who shows up, who's in armor.
Yep.
The two mysterious fighters, and then also the Baroness's surprise costume change. Are those all yours?
So the Baroness costume was art, was a reference that was given to me. The art looked like, I'm blanking on his name, the artist on the Duke series.
Okay, Tom Riley?
Yes, the art looked like his, although there was no name attached. So I assumed that's who had done the design, but I guess I don't know that. And that was super fun. Fun splash, again, cool splash page, new costume. You know, Josh called that out in the script. And so I just wanted to make her look, you know, exciting.
And then the other armor?
Oh, yeah, the other armored characters, I designed those. Josh gave a couple broad notes in the script, as I recall. And then I did a design or two and sent in with the layouts and was like, hey, this is what I'm thinking. This is why I'm thinking what I'm thinking.
May I guess that some of why you're thinking what you're thinking is that since it's a surprise who's in those costumes, you don't want the reader to think it might be Joe's or maybe even Cobra. So
yes.
It can't look like Joe or Cobra.
Yes.
Ah.
Yeah.
Right.
We were trying to misdirect a little bit, and I wanted them to have a look that maybe, yeah, wasn't easy to sort of pick out what some of the reveals might be.
Mark, do you have a question about Easter eggs?
Oh, I was just going to note that looking at the roughs or the layouts for the page, it sort of looks very different to roughs that I've seen before in terms of you using this distinct color coding to call out a specific character. In this case, it's the Baroness in yellow.
Right.
Is that for your benefit or for purposes of getting a Hasbro sign off? Or
I don't do that all the time. I tend to do that if I'm working with somebody for the first time or new, or I think there might be some confusion. So in this case, I hadn't worked with Joshua before, and I just wanted, when I turn it in, it's a Baroness story. She's the main character. So sometimes I'll just drop in a little color just to make it very clear. Like, this is how she tracks through the story, you know, as she's the protagonist. I've done it a couple times if there are characters that would look similar in layouts. And, you know, I'll make one green and one, you know, red or whatever just to help with that. But most of my layouts would look just like these, only without the added orange color that is present here.
Did you have any interaction with colorist Mike Spicer on this, or did you handed your art and the editor handed it over?
Yeah, I didn't have a lot of interaction off the front end. And then when I got colors back from Sean, from Mike, I had a couple small notes where I was like, hey, what if we did this or what if we did that? But the deadline was pretty tight on the color side of it. So Mike, you know, did a championship job turning the job around in on deadline, and we made a couple little tweaks and here we are. But he, like, it was his call, like, to go with like that red page for the Baroness reveal, and I thought that worked super good.
Yeah, it's very striking. I think the Easter eggs that Tim sort of alluded to was this great sequence towards the back end of the story where we're sort of seeing these files on Hawk's desk, and we see Destro open shirt with a hairy chest with a little bit of a mass device in the background. We get the first in story look at the Tomax and Zaymot, the Dreadnought's base on fire, which I think is alluding to the events of Cobra Commander. Mm-hmm. And then, at the end, we see an Autobot sign on Hawk's file.
Is that what that is?
I just want to say thank you, Jason, for drawing the Autobot sigil by hand. There's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with artists who stamp it in Photoshop, or who leave it blank and let the color artist stamp it in Photoshop. But I do appreciate artists who draw Autobot and Decepticon symbols, particularly when they're at an angle or in perspective. But it always just feels 5% more authentic. Like it's not floating.
Yeah, I prefer that look also. Just, I feel like it feels cohesive with the artwork. And also, you know, who prefers that is people who buy original artwork prefer that.
Yeah. For me, the thing jumping out of these Easter eggs is Destro, sort of bizarrely enough, Destro, because the look of the original design of the character and stuff, he's kind of got this sort of flesh-colored, peach-colored sort of chest, and it's kind of slightly left up to your imagination. Is that like an undershirt? Is it a beige shirt with his, you know, with his top sort of flared out like a crazed man? And here it's a definite take. And I don't know that I've seen this before by having the chest there. It's like, yeah, this is a chest. He's got his shirt open.
I've always interpreted it as that's his chest, that's his personality. He's got his chest open, the long V, the whole thing. And, you know, I guess Joshua didn't specify that one way or the other. That was an artistic call. So hopefully, I guess that's canon now, and they're going to have to look at it.
Jason, can you talk a little bit about how you see your art and your drawing style? Because comparing Cemetery Beach and Trees and Big Girls and this story to that astounding Wolfman cover.
Correct.
There are more lines. There are more details. There is less of a graphical quality and more like delineation. And your art to me is sort of this combination of rounded and organic and yet also like flat and geometric.
Mm-hmm.
And I do see a lot of thin lines, but then also sometimes I'll see just a really thick line, like here, you know, inking this kicking leg. Can you talk about either how your art has changed or sort of how you see it now?
So it has changed. Some of that is intentional and some is just, this is where I'm at in my life and this is the experiences I have. And this is how I draw now. The intentional part is when I started, say, on Wolfman, I had been doing art for smaller publishers that was more, I guess I'll use the word illustrative, more rendering, more shadows. And it was just a time-consuming process. And so because I had a day job, I wanted to make comics, and I didn't want to spend a whole week on one page. I was trying to find ways, what are effective storytelling art things that I can do to be able to get comics to happen for me around a day job? And one of the things that I landed on was sort of simplifying my style to a much more open line, you know, graphic kind of angular approach that felt very comfortable for me to draw in. And I felt allowed me to do storytelling and still, I thought, looked kind of cool. So that was some of the stuff Robert saw. And when I started with him, that's sort of where I was at. And Wolfman, you know, I leaned into that a little bit because, again, now I'm drawing a comic that needs to come out regularly. And, you know, it's just a lot of work. And there was a point where I was like, I feel like I'm drowning artistically trying to make comics on a schedule. I just had a ton to learn on how to do that. As I sort of learned things and got faster, then I felt like I want to start exploring. And even by the end of the Wolfman run, my art was more detailed than it was at the beginning of the Wolfman run. And that was because things that were hard to me 20 issues ago were suddenly easy for me. And so I had more time and I wanted to push myself and I wanted to find, you know, what's the next step. The other aspect about it that's intentional is I like to think about what makes sense for a project. So for Trees, I knew I had scripts from Warren. I knew what we had talked about with the story. And I wanted a look that felt more mature. I also wanted a look that felt like it matched this sort of broken world that the story took place in. And very grounded, even though it's a sci-fi story, it's very grounded, character-based. And I didn't want something that felt like slam, bang, you know, punchy action comics. But I didn't want something that felt like photorealistic. I wanted it to look artsy-ish and still work with action, but have a lot of kind of texture to it. And I had been doing some work in my sketchbook with a lot more of a sketchy kind of style. And so that was intentional with Trees. And I guess with each project, I've tried to think about what's necessary. So with the Energon covers, I had been doing work recently that was a little more shadow focused, I guess. Like I was thinking about shadows and graphic shapes in the shadows and trying to find a balance with detail lines, but still kind of big, bold shadow shapes. And so when the Free Comic Book Day story came about, it made sense for me to just try to continue that. And so find things where there's big, bold black areas, but also nice detail and spots, and try to find that kind of balance.
And what I'm seeing in the art is sort of a little bit, you know, compared to maybe some of the more traditional G.I. Joe art, is a little bit more cartooning, a little bit more exaggeration. And if I was to, you know, put a Venn diagram of maybe some of the crossover of like the arts, I'm sort of thinking of Ryan Ottley, Ryan Stegman, Eric Larson, that kind of school. Is there any particular sort of styles that you from other artists that you feel like most influenced by or most kind of akin to?
Definitely. I think, however, my ink sort of finishing style, my layouts kind of look the same on everything. And I do like art that looks drawn, like it looks like a person drew this face, but I want to be able to read emotions and feel movement. And that a lot of times comes in the cartooning and exaggeration of things. I know both the Ryans that you mentioned, and I think we all kind of share some influences. You know, Eric Larson was definitely one for me. A lot of the image guys, you know, I really looked at. Jason Pearson back in the day, I felt he had a real sweet spot where his figures were just very emotive, very dynamic, but his worlds were pretty realistic, and it just felt like, man, he's got it all, like the total package, and he could draw brilliantly. So there's definitely, you know, some of that there where I like the cartoony stuff, but I also like stuff that feels, I don't know, structurally correct. You know, I don't always like that word when you come to art, because I don't know if there is a right or wrong, but you know, I guess you could say anatomically there is technically a level of correctness, and I don't want to be a slave to it, but I want to be aware that it exists.
So the big question, I guess, at the end of this, and it might be a difficult question to ask or answer, is that obviously this sort of series is called, you know, this strip is called G.I. Joe. An ongoing G.I. Joe series is definitely being hinted at and alluded to. You're drawing this special. What sort of conclusions might we be able to draw?
I can neither confirm nor deny that feels like the G.I. Joe code name special ops answer I should be giving in any question relating to my future with the Energon Universe stuff.
I will phrase it as a statement. If Mark's question bounced off your classified armor, it would be great to see you draw more of this stuff. And that's coming from someone who really wants more big girls.
Oh, thank you.
So I'll just vote for both.
Yeah, both. You know? I mean, who needs sleep? I mean, I could be drawing in the car as easily as doing a podcast in the car. So
you do not consider yourself someone who would only pencil so that someone else would ink your work?
I have done that a little bit. Cliff Rathburn inked some Super Dinosaur issues, the last big chunk of that run. and I was penciling that digitally and he was inking that. That was a simpler style for me, and some of the deadlines on that stuff was pretty quick. I would not typically want to do that, but I'm not opposed to it, but my career path has sort of taken me through the creator-owned route, and I really enjoy that, and I like having as much say as possible on the final product. I think some of that comes from my background getting into comics a little bit later, like after a day job where I was doing designy art directory things and had specific vision for stuff. I kind of came into comics with that approach, like I have a vision of what I want this to look like, so when I can come in onto a project and be involved on the creative side, work with a writer, kind of think about or discuss how we want this to be, like, what is this thing going to look like? And then execute that. Like, that for me is really fun. But I working on stuff like this is also fun because you're like, oh, you know, Josh, is it putting things in the script? It's not like we sat down and talked about what G.I. Joe is. You know, he just wrote a cool Baroness story, and there's tons of fun stuff in there. And Mike brings his own flavor on the color. So I think both approaches are good. But coming from a creator place, a lot of times budget is a concern. So I learned to ink myself off the jump because I didn't want to pay somebody X amount a page if I'm getting this little window of money. And I have to cut out some of that to give to somebody else, then you like, it makes it not very attainable, you know, or not very doable for the money. So you're like, well, if I ink myself, I get to keep that money. Well, if I color myself, I get to keep that part of the money. And then now maybe a creator-owned book that wouldn't have paid great, still maybe doesn't pay great, but it pays enough to make it worth doing. And you're risking some on the back end, but, you know, that's part of the, you know, kind of comics career decision-making process.
I'm forgetting. Who colored Big Girls?
I did. Okay. I did everything except the lettering on that. Stephen Finch, Fonographics, did the lettering and some of the interior design stuff for that.
Can you describe what a Joshua Williams script is? I didn't say that as a full sentence. Can you describe what a Joshua Williamson script looks like compared to, say, another writer, you know, say Robert Kirkman?
They're not dissimilar in that one of the things I think Robert does really well, and if you've read his comics, is he knows, or he seems to recognize, what are the big character moments? Like, what is it that makes this cool? Like, there's a story, you know, we all like stories and characters, but what is it that makes this story worth telling? You know, what's the moment? What's the reveal? What's the shock? What is it? Why are we seeing now instead of, you know, the story where Baroness gets coffee for five pages? You know, well, that's boring. We don't want to see that. You know, we want to see this. I mean, maybe we do. Maybe there's an angle there. Somebody could write that story.
Is Brian Michael Bendis doing a Baroness story?
What's in the coffee?
Right, exactly.
Is she wearing this armor?
Right. So when I read Joshua's script, I was like, oh, okay, this is familiar beats for me. I haven't worked with Joshua before, but reading it, I was like, it's got moments. It's paced well. Yeah, it's very clear. He's worked, you know, tons of stuff, lots of big projects. He's a pro, and, you know, in his script right off the jump is like, it's easy to read. I mean, for me as an artist, I get it, and it's like, no questions. It's all right there. He knows what he's doing. And as I read it and start to lay it out, then I've got the, oh, yep, perfect. Oh, nice. We get to do this. Oh, cool. I get to splash page of Baroness. So it's all right there. And then I like stories that have a reveal or twist. Again, it goes back to the why are we telling this? So as that short little story wraps up, we get a little reveal and tease, and you see there's maybe more going on than we thought at the beginning.
And you kind of alluded to this. Was there a little bit of a back and forth where you were doing the roughs and sharing those back with Joshua just to check in and say, is this what you were expecting?
Yep. I sent the layouts. And he, as I recall, he had one comment at the end we see General Hawk in a different location than his office. I don't remember how it was in the script. I interpreted it that way in the script, that it was a different location, like some kind of secret tech, you know, command center-y kind of thing. And when he saw the layout, he asked, which I thought was cool, you know, he's like, from a story place, do you think it'd make more sense or be simpler to just have this all happen in the office at the end? And I was like, honestly, I think it's cooler to be this, because there's kind of secrecy stuff happening that he wouldn't want those people in his office. He would want the secret stuff to be happening off, you know, either in some underground or offsite base or bunker. I was like, I think that actually makes story sense, but, you know, you're the writer, do what you want. He's like, no, that's a good idea. We're going to stick with it. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it's got the Doctor Strangelove war room light in the ceiling.
Yeah, yeah, the big circle light, that was my addition, but I wanted something that kind of graphically just felt kind of cool. So
it creates space and is, assuming you can draw ellipses, not hard to draw.
Not hard at all.
It's not like he's in like a converted like football arena and you're drawing, right, you know, 800 seats.
I was going to say, here's a very basic G.I. Joe fanboy question. Do you have a favorite Joe and a favorite Cobra?
So I haven't had the opportunity to draw a lot of them. Destro, both here and on the cover, was super fun. I mean, he's got wrist rockets. I feel like that kind of makes him pretty awesome. Snake Eyes, you know, if this has not happened, this is not a spoiler, this is not anything, I'm just saying, if at some point somebody were to say, hey, do you want to draw like comic books with snake eyes in them? I'd be like, oh, that'd be pretty cool. The toy that I loved the most as a kid was Junkyard, because his weapon was the dog. And that was like the best when you're playing with your figures and you have the little plastic dog. So as a toy, he was my favorite.
Yeah, he's Martin Junkyard. My first ever Joe toy that I ever bought, and definitely one of my favorites.
My brother's second. Since the Joes may meet some Transformers in the future, just can you give us, Jason, the one sentence history of you and Transformers? Did you watch the show, buy the toys, read the comics? Have you followed?
Yep, all the stuff. Similar with the Joes. I mean, where I lived, I assume this is similar. Most places in the U.S., they were like back to back. So I'd get home from school, G.I. Joe and Transformers were on either right back to back, or maybe there was something in between, but it was that block of get home from school, watch cartoon, you know, eat a bag of potato chips kind of time. So yeah, I had Transformers toys. I would draw Transformers. You know, I didn't mention this with the Joes, but when I was like learning to draw the toy packaging with the figure pose, you know, your background here with the explosion, I would draw those guys just because I was like, oh, there's a cool looking dude and he's got muscles. How do I draw that? And I'd look at it and I'd draw it in my little sketchbooks. And so, yeah, Transformers is probably where my sort of love of robot media began. My kids would tell you, if we scroll through Netflix and there's a picture of some terrible looking movie, but it has a robot predominantly featured, we might end up watching 5 or 10 minutes of that just to see if it's maybe it might be good. We have to find out. It could be cool.
In the last say 20 years, when you weren't a kid buying, watching, playing with these things as a kid, as a grown-up watching, reading, or appreciating, were you following these two brands in the last 20-25 years?
I wasn't reading them regularly. I would occasionally check out books. There was some Joe comics I picked up for a bit. They were written. Aubrey Sitterson used to be an editor that I worked with. And then Giannis, or I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce his name, but I really like his art a lot. And they did a run that I picked up and was totally there for. I remember back when the Dreamwave stuff was big on the Transformers side, I would occasionally pick up comics just to like stay in the loop of what was going on. but I haven't followed them super religiously as far as like being invested in the story pretty much as an adult, more of like, oh, there's somebody, you know, doing something cool, or, oh, that cover looks awesome, let me pick up this issue. So there might be random issues in my collection, but not a run of the stuff.
I get the sense from comics professionals that I know that while there may be time to be a fan of things, to like go to movies and watch TV, some of that time is sort of while they're drawing. They've also got a show on.
Right.
And also, you just mentioned kids. So I'm going to guess that the last big chunk of years, much of your time has been accounted for.
Yeah, although I still, like, this afternoon before the podcast, I was flipping through and reading a couple of comics. Sunday afternoon's usually pretty chill time for us, so. But yeah, there are other responsibilities, but I like comics, and I still read lots of comics. You know, I don't buy as many hard copy comics as I used to. I still do. I was in the comic store maybe 2 weeks ago. I'll read a lot on my iPad. I find that to be, for me, not having a lot of stacks of comics around the house, it's easy. I have my iPad usually near me, and, you know, that's been an easy way in recent years. But I have stacks of comics by my drawing table, things I've read, things friends have drawn, you know, just art that somebody says, have you checked out this art? And I'll go buy the book. So. Although sometimes I find I'm in that phase where I'm buying stuff I already have, but it's in a, this afternoon when I was in the comic store, I bought it was X-Men 268, the Jim Lee, Chris Claremont issue with Captain America and Black Widow. I don't know.
But, did you get the facsimile edition or the original?
Yeah. Cause that facsimile edition came out. I was like, I know I have this somewhere. I don't know where it is. I want to read that comic. And so I paid $4 for the stupid comic that, you know, Marvel paid the artist for, you know, 30 years ago.
As a big fan of the G.I. Joe from Marvel, I wouldn't know anything about buying exactly the same content about four or five times in different editions.
Yes.
As someone who explained facsimile editions to a customer yesterday, I like to point out that the paper is different. It's modern, shiny,
it's glossy paper. Yeah.
And I wouldn't get into this with a customer, but the colors have a different saturation relative to the bright white of the paper, as opposed to the dull newsprint of 1989.
Yes. I did notice the color style where, you know, like a background might be solid green to separate it from the characters. That was pretty common in pre-computer age coloring on that X-Men looked very saturated and bright compared to my memory, which I felt like was a much duller sort of shade. That is very, nobody cares about that.
Tim cares a lot.
Oh man.
People care. Here we go. We're going to do a podcast. The details of comics coloring and facsimile edition.
No, Mark,
Tim,
I promise
could quite happily do a series of 10 episodes, 2 hours a piece, just talking about that one subject.
I'll do this in one sentence, Mark, just for our guests' benefit. Jason, something like that is of great interest because, for example, Skybound has announced reprinting the Marvel G.I. Joe.
And
they're going to reprint it on newsprint.
Oh, cool.
Which is interesting, even from a budgeting perspective, because I had heard 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that part of why so few comics have been printed on newsprint is that newsprint got more expensive than glossy stock. And then in terms of production, like what are the saturations? What files are they prepping? Because newsprint can only hold so much ink compared to crappy newsprint or glossy paper. Period. I'm done. Mark, back to you. The episode's over.
I was going to start wrapping up and just say thank you so much, Jason, for joining us. And I'm so glad that you've arrived all in one piece. You know, the screen is still the right way around. That's fantastic. Obviously, if people aren't yet following you on Twitter, I won't say X, or on Instagram, you know, make sure that you're doing that. Instagram is Jason Howard Art. Twitter is the Jason Howard. Yeah. Anything else that you'd want to point our listeners at this point in time?
No, I mean, if you like, I tend to be more active on Instagram. So if you like some behind the scenes, I try to put the stuff on there I want to see from other artists, which is, I've seen your finished thing, but it's always cool. I want to see your inks. I want to see your sketches. So I try to do that stuff on posts. You know, there's not a lot of drama there, so I don't know that it drives the algorithm, but, you know, hopefully if people are interested in that, they check it out. And, yeah, I don't think I can really talk about a lot of stuff. Recent comics work, most of my comic storytelling the past year, year and a half or so, has been with Three Worlds, Three Moons, 3w3m.com, which is Jonathan Hickman's sort of online presence. And so there is free story content, free comics there that I've drawn. And there will be, I think, print versions of that stuff coming in the future. But in the meantime, yeah, I'm doing a lot of these Energon Universe covers. And yeah, I would totally have fun doing more interiors. So we'll see what happens on all that stuff. So, yeah.
Excellent. So I think that just remains for us to say thank you so much for joining us, taking the time and digging into the detail to find out a little bit more about your history in comics, and specifically all about the very latest free comic book day Energon Universe issue, which here's a question I had thought about. Knowing how many sets of eyes go on a free comic book day like this, does that sort of put a bigger amount of pressure on you as an artist, knowing that it's probably going to have that much higher of a print run?
Yes, the answer is yes. I don't know if all artists are, but I'm very aware. I've done a couple free comic book day things now. The Wolfman issue, the first one was for that. And that was incredibly stressful then because I was an unknown. It's like, and Brian Otley and Corey Walker were, you know, drawing Invincible, and they're amazing. And I was like, I'm just getting started. I don't know what I'm doing. Everybody's going to look at it. They're all going to, you know, hate it or what, you know, your art brain will spin a little bit. I am much more confident now, but with this, I was very aware. All right, a lot of people are going to see this. So make sure you draw your backgrounds, you know, do the fun things like that, you know, where maybe if it's issue 7, page 14, you're on a deadline. You're like, all right, this page gets very little backgrounds. I got to move on. This, it's like, all right, 8 pages, every page has to count. So for me, I was aware of it. So.
Interesting stuff. Okay, perfect. I think, yeah, you can feel free to drop off. I think Tim and me will do the normal kind of wrap up.
Well, thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. It was super fun. And thanks for being patient with the car and the occasional dropouts. Hopefully the quality of it all works for you guys. All right.
Thank
cool.
you. Thank you again for your time. And as a fan and reader, thank you for this. It was awesome.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Back to G.I. Joe. So, Tim, that was really cool talking to Jason Howard. Really interesting stuff and some interesting hints at what the, you know, future might bring. So I'm sure, even if it's just covers, we've definitely not seen the end of Jason in the Energon universe. So be interested to see what comes next.
I will just go back to one comment. A thought that I had, because I kept referring to Big Girls, this creator-owned book that Jason Howard wrote and drew and colored for Image. And there's a skinny paperback of all, I forget, 6 issues or 5 issues. And I think it's a great story, and it's an interesting concept. In the future, some males become giant monsters. And so some girls are made big to fight them. So it's sort of a kaiju book, but in like kind of a like destroyed future New York City. But it's a little bit about sort of gender and power. Part of why I think it's surprisingly great is that Jason Howard pulls off a real trick in drawing regular sized human scale people, like 5 feet and 6 feet, and also sort of buildings, and then also giant people and giant monsters. And that's not an easy thing to be able to lay out. I mean, if you draw okay, or you've made some comics, but you haven't made a lot of comics, you might be used to drawing at one scale, right? Like, oh, my superpowered characters are fighting my other superpowered characters. Or in my G.I. Joe fan fiction, the Joes are infiltrating Cobra Base. It is a different thing when you need a 6-foot character next to a 60-foot character. Like, how do you actually compose the page or use camera angles? And then to have fights. And it reminded me of what it's like to draw a Transformers comic, because you have giant robots and people. And I don't know if, and I actually don't think, Jason Howard will be drawing a Transformers comic in the future. But if anyone is going to contribute to the Energon universe going forward, they might draw people and robots. And besides this G.I. Joe story, which just has G.I. Joe sized characters, Mr. Howard is capable of drawing a story that could have Joe sized people and Autobot and Decepticon sized people. All right.
So yeah, let's get into the detail of the Energon Universe Free Comic Book Day. Should we talk about some covers?
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
The actual Free Comic Book Day itself only has one cover, which is the Megatron by Ryan Ottley. But then in the middle of the week, on Wednesday, there is a subsequent release of the Energon Universe 2024 special as a $3.99 regular issue. The main difference being that there's different covers. So there's a number of,
there's five covers. Yeah. So,
and also I think as well, a subtle difference is something that we're beginning to see in the Energon Universe comics, which is the back cover. Has a cover gallery of all of the variants, which is very exciting to see if that is becoming a trend.
Yeah, so it is technically called Energon Universe Free Comic Book Day 2024 Special. So this was shipped to comic book stores and libraries, I should say. Libraries can participate in Free Comic Book Day. I don't know the details. I don't know if it's I don't know how much it has to do with if there isn't a comic book store nearby or if there's just an enterprising librarian, but this was shipped to stores in advance of May 4th, 2024, which was the first Saturday in May, and Skybound is following suit. That's something that Marvel has now done once or twice, where Marvel publishes its Free Comic Book Day comic and then soon after publishes it as a comic with a cover price. In Marvel's case, this comic has been called Marvel Zero. And at first I thought this was cynical. Like, aren't there enough copies of these free books out there already? Now you're encouraging people to buy them again or buy them by accident or buy them just for a new cover. And then I realized, well, there are lots of people who don't live near a comic book store or a participating library. So now I am in favor of this, although I do think that having five covers for the Energon Universe special is a lot. So the initial cover for the Free Comic Book Day edition is drawn by Ryan Ottley with colors by Annalisa Leone, and it is Megatron with his arm and his arm cannon, his fusion cannon, that we have not seen in Cobra Commander or in Transformers issues. Megatron is looking slightly down at us. He's backlit. Much of his front is in shadow. He has red glowing eyes, but you can't see his face. There isn't much of a background. There's some sort of scratchy electrical indication of shadow or rubble around his feet. And then he's in some kind of metal hallway, tech hallway, that's mostly orange with some brighter yellow in the distance on the bottom left. And his fusion cannon is smoking. Ryan Ottley draws a slightly organic Megatron. This is not the like shoebox 1980s robot of Jose Delbo Marvel Comics. This is not the like cut paper, graphical geometric Jeff Senior Transformers of Marvel UK and Marvel US and IDW comics. This is there some little bits of Megatron here are slightly rounded, like his thighs. Mm. But it's a cool cover, and it looked good on shelf at my store yesterday, amongst all the other Free Comic Book Day comics. If you want, after we go through the covers, we can talk about Free Comic Book Day itself as an event. All right, so for the...
Okay.
So arriving in comic book stores on sale May 8th, that's a Wednesday, 2029, is the Energon Universe 2024 special, issue number one, which is, again, the Free Comic Book Day comic with a cover price. Cover A is Daniel Warren Johnson and Mike Spicer with Megatron and Prime fighting each other. Each of them have their More Than Meets the Eye Part 3 weapons from the 1984 episode instead of hands. Cover B is Lorenzo De Felici, who's the artist of Void Rivals. And this is these two aliens from season 3 of Transformers, the animated show from 86, who have been appearing in the Void Rivals comic. And then we get to cover C, which is a 1-in-10 ratio variant. It's drawn and colored by Tom Riley, and it is the Baroness in her black non-Cobra outfit that we saw in much of the Duke miniseries. There's a strong diagonal to this because she's got one gun up at the ready and one gun out as if to fire, but she's aiming it down left. And behind her is the Star and Three Stripes G.I. Joe logo in blue and white. And it is making a southwest to northeast diagonal. There's no background. Behind it is just light blue, but maybe it's like she's standing in front of a wall with this Star and Stripes logo, because there are three that's not the quote wall behind her getting hit. Excuse me. She has just fired three rounds. That's what this is.
I think you're right.
So her arm is sweeping from sort of straight in front of her to out to her side. And those three yellow bursts are where she did just fire her pistol. She is slightly warm in her complexion. Her complexion is not just sort of standard Caucasian, but there's a lot of red in it, I think partly to set her off from the blue background, and also because she's lit by this yellow light of her pistol firing. Anything about this cover you want to say, Mark?
No, it's cool. And it's good to see Tom Riley, but I don't have a huge amount to add beyond that.
Cover D is the 1-in-25 ratio variant. It's drawn by Stephen Green, who at first glance I wasn't familiar with, and I had to do a little computer digging. Stephen Green drew an image series that was co-written by Jason Aaron and Dennis, quote, Hopeless Hollum, called Sea of Stars. This Energon Universe cover is Flint and Lady J parachuting in. She is in the background firing off a javelin from a cool javelin firing weapon. And he has his shotgun, not his sawed off shotgun, but a shotgun with a butt. As with the A and B covers, these both have a lot of black ink as the dominant background because they are in front of a night sky, in this case, parachuting through the night sky. But Flint is underlit on the bottom left. You see a little bit of an explosion. He's underlit in pink or magenta, the rest of his tones have a lot of blue on them, I think, as if lit by a moon overhead. Lady J is not completely knocked out in purple, but you don't really see any green on her. Again, this cover, if you squint, this cover is about sort of red, blue, purple. There's a tiny bit of teal on the bottom right. I should add something I forgot to mention. The Free Comic Book Day edition of this comic book on the top of the cover, of course, has the horizontal Free Comic Book Day logo and no credits. The version you can buy for $3.99 has the writers and artists' last names over the title on all of these covers. And then lastly, cover E is the 1-in-50 variant. It's drawn by Carrie Randolph, and it is Hot Rod drawn in something very close to an animated style, if not an animated style, and it it seems to recall a moment from the 1986 Transformers animated movie where Hot Rod, I guess at this point in the movie, it's Rodimus Prime, is running toward us within Unicron, and there are green glowing explosions happening around him.
Cool. So talking about the issue overall, it's brought to us from the team with editors Sean Makowicz and Jonathan Manning, a designer Andre Juarez, and letterer Russ Wooten, all familiar names from the Energon universe so far, with three distinct stories: Transformers, Void Rivals, and G.I. Joe. Great. Let's get into the insides of this ear comic as well. Let's look at the G.I. Joe story first up. It's brought to us by writer Joshua Williamson, the same writer who has brought us Duke and Cobra Commander, artist Jason Howard, colorist Mike Spicer, who has been coloring the Transformers book.
Plot breakdown.
Following the events of the Duke miniseries, he has been tasked with building a special mission force. Duke suggests to Colonel Hawk that he recruits Baroness, aka Anastasia Sisarovna. This does not go down well, but he decides to go ahead anyway. We catch up with the Baroness as she is being attacked by two mysterious agents dressed in a futuristic black outfit. Duke comes to the rescue on a motorbike and whisks her away with the offer to join him on his team or face a life behind bars or on the run. Baroness gets kitted out in new togs and agrees to join with a yo-jo. Later, Hawk meets with the two agents in black. We discover that they were Flint and Lady J, and that they had been trying to recruit Baroness as well. Apparently, Hawk is making more than one team, and he doesn't want Duke to know about it. To be continued in G.I. Joe.
Mark, what's your top-down take on this story?
Top-down, it's 8 pages, and they do get away with doing quite a lot in those 8 pages. I think short stories are always difficult to be satisfying, and it talks to the capabilities of the team here that they do deliver a satisfying story. And it seems to be this coda, this sort of full stop to the Duke miniseries issue five of Duke, where Hawk is tasking him with this, setting up this new team. So it's a sort of direct continuation of that. And it's also picking up where we saw Baroness last, picking up to the extent that she's got broken glasses, broken in the same place when we last saw her in Duke issue 4. And as well as sort of, you know, following up and closing out kind of the threads of Duke, they're sort of setting up this wider story and this new mystery of, you know, Baroness in this new costume as part of Duke's team, and this this mystery of a second Joe team that Lady J and Flint are doing. So it's sort of, yeah, it's really good at sort of this having this connective tissue between what's come before and setting up future stories, which was very satisfying.
My big take is that this fits a lot into 8 pages, which I really appreciate. And I don't think that fully occurred to me until just now when we were speaking with Jason Howard, and he referred to Joshua Williamson's script as having a lot in it. But when you look at each of these pages, Howard is he's moving the camera all over the place. He's drawing backgrounds. There are all of his different poses and facial expressions. So there's a lot of value and economy in this short story, which is, for an 8-pager, a must, for a G.I. Joe story, a thrill, and for a free comic book day item, urgently important. What's really exciting is that within this 8-pager, there's a splash page. So, you know, you wouldn't count this as 7 pages and one panel, a big panel, but again, I mean, you have to be good at drawing and laying out pages, visualizing a script, to put all this stuff in here and not have anything get lost, But that's the minimum, right? Not only do things not get lost, it's really exciting, you know? Like, Duke doesn't just walk up to the Baroness. He doesn't just pull up on a motorcycle. He jumps up on a motorcycle, right? That's really cool. You know, like, sometimes we forget that, you know, any scene in a story can be sort of amped up and have a wow factor. And there might be good story reasons why Duke should approach the Baroness quietly from the other end of this, you know, alley. But, you know, you turn the page and I thought, cool, there's Duke. Like, cool, Duke's on a motorcycle. Cool, Duke and the motorcycle are doing something cool. Like, oh, Howard also fit in two cars and a bus in the background. Like, oh, there are a bunch of speed lines drawn in perspective above and to the right of Duke, which in the original art that we're looking at right now, if you're watching the visual of this, looks like just sort of perspective for where Duke is heading. If you look at the color art, that seems to be about the headlights on the motorcycle. Anyway, I love how much is in here. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's 5 characters. Some of these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you know, these pages have many panels on them. There are tiny reveals and hints for upcoming G.I. Joe stuff. It is both, as you said, an epilogue to Duke and also a prologue for whatever comes next. You know, the hawk that we were worried about at the beginning of the Duke miniseries and that we felt better about at the end of the Duke miniseries. Now I'm worried about him again. Like he's not a villain, but oh no, he is some kind of authority figure that Duke can't fully trust, or he's keeping something from Duke.
Not quite playing with a straight bat.
Yeah,
I think that's what they say in cricket.
I also got excited at the very bottom right of the final page because it says "to be continued in G.I. Joe," and I have suspected based on the like San Diego Comic-Con July promo poster from last year, if I'm getting my dates right, I have suspected that the new G.I. Joe comic would be called Codename G.I. Joe, not G.I. Joe, to better differentiate it from Larry Hama's G.I. Joe, Early American Hero, and it
other G.I. Joe.
it still could, but the logo type we see on the last page of the Free Comic Book Day story doesn't say Codename G.I. Joe. It says G.I. Joe. And interestingly, this is the modern Hasbro version of the G.I. Joe logo type, where there are no periods and there's a slight cut out of the top of the I and the top of the J to better fit the star. This is what Hasbro uses on G.I. Joe classified action figures. And I think this is what Renegade uses on all of its game packaging. But in all of those, it's a flat white. There's no outline. And I think in all of those, there's just the flat white and the three stripes are just white. There's no red and white and blue. So this might be the first time we've seen this modern revision of the G.I. Joe logo. What I'm going to say is like the 2021 and up logo without the periods, with the tiny cuts in the I and the J, but with an outline and with the red and the blue.
In the credits page, actually, funny enough, they do have that all white G.I. Joe logo. Above, you know, for the G.I. Joe story itself, it's just G.I. Joe all in white.
And that might be
describing.
That might be a design decision so that it matches better with the Void Rivals logo type and the Transformers logo type also on the inside front cover.
You did sort of, you know, hinting that maybe we're getting this called G.I. Joe, but in the back page, which doesn't, the back page sort of editorial from Sean Mekowicz, which doesn't give too much extra away. It sort of recaps that we've had year one and we're sort of heading into year two. You know, we've had Duke and Cobra Commander. We're going to have Scarlet and Destro, and both miniseries will continue to chart the formation of Codename G.I. Joe and Cobra and introduce your favorite and soon to be favorite characters and explore plenty of uncharted territory in this incredible shared universe, but not necessarily giving too much away. But yeah, it's interesting to sort of see that they're seeing this as almost this special as being kind of that midpoint that we've had a good chunk of initial story where we've had Cobra, Duke, we've had a good chunk of Void Rivals, which has had, you know, that pause and then restarted, and then we've had the first 6 months plus of Transformers and that kind of marked difference with a kind of a first arc of the first six issues and then a new artist introduced as well. So it's sort of coinciding that after the initial burst of the first arc almost of the Energon universe.
The title of this editorial text page on the inside back cover is surprising. Welcome to year two of the Energon universe. I feel like, you know, it's a little hard to count because Void Rivals took a break after issue six. And I think now 7 and 8 have come out. I forget. But, you know, sort of scratching my head. Oh, are we at month 13? Okay, well, no, not yet. But we're heading into year two. In terms of package design and editorial, I do feel like this page of text from the editor is a good place to have the cover of the Transformers Volume 1 trade paperback, which is also on sale this coming Wednesday, May 8th, the same day that the Energon Universe special with the cover price is on sale. I feel like this text page wants the three volume ones depicted. I want to see a cover of Duke Volume 1, a cover of Transformers Volume 1, a cover of Void Rivals Volume 1, with a couple words that says, get this at your local comic book store. And I thought for a second, well, they could have put that on the back cover. There's just this ad on the back cover. And the ad on the back cover is a little confusing because I know what it is, but I feel like if you don't know what comics are, you don't know what this back cover is depicting, because it sort of refers to Free Comic Book Day, but it also looks like there's a city, but there's a barcode, and what it is it's supposed to look like a generic comic book that has been sealed in a Lucite CGC case with its grade, and on the top it says CGC Universal Grade, and instead of the title it says your book. So it's sort of like, hey folks, you can get your comics slabbed. That's the idea. And then I realized, oh right, CGC, the Comics Guarantee Corporation, was this year's sponsor of Free Comic Book Day.
Okay.
Like one year it was Coca-Cola, and I think a bunch of the early years there was no sponsor. Yes, CGC gets an ad. And in the case of this Energon Universe book, they got the back cover. For some of the other ones, I think they got a page inside and not the back cover. And similarly, listeners, if you are looking at this Free Comic Book Day Energon Universe special and you see this light white box on the bottom left of the cover under Ryan Ottley's signature, that is a place for your local comic book store to either put a sticker with its name and, you know, address, or if it has an ink stamper with its name and address or website. Some of the Free Comic Book Day comics have a pure white rectangle. Some of them have this light white rectangle, so you can still see some of the art. Some of them don't have it at all. I know that some stores really want to be able to label their free comics so that if someone comes into the store, gets a free comic, goes off somewhere else a week, a month, 6 months later, they pull out the Free Comic Book Day comic and they think, where did I get this? And they see the name of the store and the address, then they know to go back there. I know that my employees and I, the night before Free Comic Book Day, wouldn't want to spend all the time putting stickers on every Free Comic Book Day comic or stamping them with an ink stamper. So we don't, but I totally dig it if a store does want to. So anyway, that's why there is a weird ad for CGC on the back.
Okay. There was a couple of key sort of what the moments for me on page turns for this book. I counted about four or five. One of them was the Lady J and Flint reveal with them being on this sort of parallel Joe team, which is, you know, a really interesting plot point. And then the other one was the Baroness in this sort of Stars and Stripes costume, Looking very, you know, very kind of superhero-esque, something a little bit more like out of the Marvel universe, perhaps, than the Joe one. What did you think of the page turn for the Baroness here in this particular costume?
Well, the previous page, you see her putting on a boot and putting on a glove, right? She's behind Duke and she's silhouetted, or you just see close-ups of her hands and feet. And I thought, oh, wait, is she putting on her Cobra costume? That wouldn't make sense. She's not a part. And then I turned the page and I thought, ha, 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 ha. It's cool. You know, she's got some armor. It looks G.I. Joe-ish, but it also refers to her costume. The knee pads look sort of like the first Duke classified toy, right? I thought it was great.
I must admit that when there was kind of the talk of Baroness being on the in the Duke book and on in that lineup, and then we seeing her in Duke, I did think that, yeah, she's just a character here in the Duke book, and they're kind of briefly allied as part of that prison break. She's not actually going to be part of some of the G.I. team. Oh, right. she is going to be part of the G.I. Joe team. So definite sort of zigzag in the plot that hadn't expected. And then we touched on the sort of the Easter eggs when we were talking to Jason Howard, so I won't linger on that, but fun to see Hawk with his mysterious file, you know, with Destro, the mass device. The mass device is something we actually saw in as a blueprint in the Duke issue one, so not mega new. The in continuity first viewing of Tomax and Zaymot, although we have seen the future covers from Destro, so we know that they're coming. And then, yeah, sort of that tie into the Dreadnoughts. Interesting that's on Hawk's radar, given that G.I. Joe hasn't yet really featured as part of the Cobra Commander book.
My other sort of comment is that these two people who attack the Baroness in these black costumes with some sort of green tech, one of them has a cape, which I thought initially was dumb. But then I realized, if you're looking at the last page, I thought, oh, that's just one more element to make them not recognizable as Joe or Cobra. And if they're futuristic or slightly superheroic or maybe even sort of alien, you know, like in the back of your mind, I think everyone is interested in or worried that aliens from Void Rivals are going to show up in G.I. Joe. And I'm sure there'll be a crossover at some point, but, you know, in the early months, maybe years, I hope not. And you look at this final page and Lady J really does have a sort of tattered cape. And I thought, well, that's fine. Also, now that since we keep making this sort of indirect allusion to G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra, the first live action movie where the Baroness and Duke have a connection, which had never been done before in G.I. Joe comics or cartoons. And the Joshua Williamson Duke miniseries does something like a version of that. Here is another, I now realize, I think inadvertent and very slight sort of comparison reference to that movie. You have two Joes in black armor, which looks a little bit like Iron Man, which is to say, these look a little bit like the Accelerator suits. And I'm on record as not liking the Accelerator suits from Rise of Cobra. But again, I sort of feel like Flint and Lady J in these costumes here with these helmets that look like DC's Vigilante, I sort of feel like we're never going to see those again. And I think that's fine. It's just for this story so they can, you know, I hope, chase down the Baroness. I think my last comment is I really like Mike Spicer's colors on Transformers. I like his colors in this Duke story. Once Jason Howard said there was a little bit of a deadline crunch for the colors, I started to wonder, oh, is there any way I could figure out if there was a page that got, you know, a little less attention? I sort of wonder if the page with Duke showing up on the motorcycle that you have had on screen, I sort of wondered, okay, this is a great page, right? Layout's great, drawing's great. I sort of wondered, okay, this all does take place in the same scene. There are no big changes, and it all takes place within the same like 10 or 20 feet. So there's no reason to have a lot of color differences. And there is that all red background in the I Hate You American panel. But the sort of color of the sky and the color of the buildings and the color of the background cars in the first panel and in the second panel, I did wonder if maybe this page, if this might be a page that the colorist had a little more time, might have done a little, put a little more differentiation into. But as far as criticisms of this comic goes, I think of that as really mild, and I still think it's a cool page. And it's really cool to be able to see the black and white art. And I really particularly appreciate, just to go back to Jason Howard's work, that final panel where he's very smartly going back and forth and back and forth between black and white. So there's the black on the far left of the side of the building or the alley. There's the light on Flint's armor. There's the white between the alley and Flint's helmet. His helmet is black. There's the white between the two characters. There's the black of the Lady J armor. There's the white immediately to the right of it, right? It just continues, just, you know, on, off, on, off, on, off. As a graphical element, it's great.
Very good. Let's plow on to the Transformers story and writer Daniel Warren Johnson, the writer of the main Transformers title, artist Ryan Ottley, famously the one of the main artists for the bulk of Invincible, and has been working for Marvel on the likes of Spider-Man more recently, colorist Annalisa Leone. And I was really just expecting this, based on what I'd seen before, for it to be, you know, Megatron versus Optimus Prime, big duke out. So it was exciting to see that it wasn't just Transformers, but also a bit of G.I. Joe in there, as I'll describe in this plot breakdown.
Plot breakdown.
Before the Transformers crash on Earth, we flash back to a fierce battle between Megatron and the Autobots. As Megatron and Optimus Prime grapple, Megatron's arm is chopped off and he is found left clinging to the Ark. Starscream shoots Megatron and he falls away from the Ark, hurtling Earthbound. Megatron awakens from this flashback and pulls himself loose from his restraints in the Cobra laboratory. He is able to connect one of his missing arms just before Globulus arrives, riding atop a giant creature, flanked by an army of Royal Guard. As they do battle, Globulus throws a spear into Megatron's eye. Megatron launches himself away and bursts through the side of the mountain into the open air. As he stands up, he vows, "I'm coming for you, Starscream." So continuing that initial thought, I was, yeah, absolutely expecting Megatron versus Optimus battle. And so the real, you know, what the moment was, hold on, half of this was Megatron versus Optimus Prime. Half of this story is Megatron in Cobra La, continuing that initial part of the story introduced in the pages of Cobra Commander issue one. So a real page turn shock, and some really cool moments of Globulus and Cobra La versus Megatron.
So Ryan Ottley has not... has done any covers in the Energon universe so far? There have been so many.
Yeah, I think he has done a couple of maybe Transformers one. I have a feeling that he has done it.
Okay, so
bound Energon universe.
So not his first connection to the Energon universe, but his first sustained one. Annalisa Leone coloring this story. This is the color artist of the Cobra Commander miniseries, and I really enjoyed the colors there. And I'm not trying to pick on Mike Spicer, who's a great color artist, but as a comparison and to complete that thought, that page from the G.I. Joe story where Duke shows up on the motorcycle. And a minute ago, I was saying, you know, if the backgrounds and the foregrounds could pop a little more, as a comparison, in this Transformer story, if you go to this page where Megatron's yelling "Starscream," and then he's pulling away and there are all these red cables, that second panel, so as a comparison, here's like, we have stuff low, we have stuff high, we have foreground, middle ground, background. The color here is a little bolder, and the Mike Spicer treatment in that Duke Baroness motorcycle panel is a little more pastel, and Megatron pops more from the background, and then the Cobra Law scientists pop a little bit more. Some of this is also about Ryan Ottley's line weight, but there's a color comparison. Anyway, I also didn't expect there to be a G.I. Joe connection in this, and what struck me about this Transformer story was actually not the G.I. Joe connections. I was really sort of caught up by the two Transformers things that happen in it, because I am a Transformers fan and I've read the 6 or 7 issues of Transformers so far. So on the first page, Megatron has both of his arms, and he has not had them in Cobra Commander or Transformers.
Yep.
And so I thought, okay, I think I know when this is set. This is set before those things. On the final panel of page one, he kills Brawn. And I thought, oh, well, on the one hand, Megatron is a tyrant and there are stakes in this book. And if you kill characters, then, you know, it's a gut punch. So cool. On the other hand, Daniel Warren Johnson has killed a lot of Transformers so far. Spoiler, skip the next sentence if you don't want to know. Bumblebee, Cup, I think RC, Huffer? Okay, back to spoiler over. So here he kills Brawn, and I think this is too many, and I think this is too early. And there are a lot of characters, so this might be a way of sort of clearing the decks, and this might be a way of saying no one is sacred. You know, I'm going to swerve left because this is a new Transformer continuity, and we may be spotlighting, you know, lesser characters or other characters. It's cool, but it also hurts my feelings. Like, no, I feel the way Prime does. Brawn, no. And certainly Megatron, I mean, if you read Megatron's file, his not his file card, his tech spec, his fusion cannon is powerful enough to kill an Autobot if he shoots an Autobot point blank in the chest, right? All right, and then the other thing that jumps out at me with this story is that Prime does slice off Megatron's arm. So we get an explanation for something which has not been a big story point in Transformers or in Cobra Commander, but has been a mystery. There's also some sort of references. You know, I feel like if you're a Transformers fan, you look at this first page and you can't help but think of More Than Meets the Eye Part 1, the first episode of Transformers, when the Decepticons board the Ark as they're going to Earth, because this is a version of that scene now in comics form in a new continuity, as well as Megatron and the Decepticons boarding the Autobot shuttle about 20 minutes into Transformers the movie. It's a famous scene where he, as he does here, kills some Autobots. And then one more reference, like that Daniel Warren Johnson cover for this issue with the cover price. If Prime replaces his hand with an Energon axe, an energy axe. That is a reference to the third episode of Transformers. And I know like every Prime toy now, you can like take his hand off and like replace it with an axe. For many years, that had only ever happened one time in one episode. And now it is a convention. I'm really struck by not just the bold color, but the bold art. I really like how Ryan Ottley subtly adds a thicker outline around his characters and foreground elements. And I appreciate you, in speaking with Jason Howard, drawing a small comparison between how these two guys draw. They certainly draw more similarly than dissimilarly, and having them bookend this special is, I think, sort of inadvertent, but cool.
Yeah, very good. I didn't have necessarily huge amounts to say about the story, because it's essentially a lot of slugging it out, but I did really enjoy the aspect of Globulus riding this sort of gigantic beast, and sort of the story idea that you know, he's this character with this tail, and I think seeing his tail
sort of coming out of the beast later on is the first time within the story that we see that he has actually got a tail, because before he's been kind of slightly shrouded. But it's kind of that, a bit like Avatar or something, where you've kind of got that creature to creature connection, sort of creating a bond. It looks like, you know, he's able to slide into the top of this creature's head and kind of form this kind of organic bond between him as the rider and this green monster as his mount.
Both of these creatures, the one that we see for several more panels and the one who's just in that initial two-thirds splash page, appear to be Ryan Ottley extrapolating Cobra Law visuals from the limited visuals we get in the animated G.I. Joe the movie. Right. If you can see Russ Heath's model sheets for G.I. Joe the movie, if you pay attention to that, you know, little montage in the movie when Globulus says, "Organisms of Cobra Law, detach and fight to the finish." And then we see like the bridge that's actually a giant like stick insect, and the like rock that's actually like a crab thing, right? So these don't feel precisely like that visual vocabulary, but close enough and fun and cool. Like, it's cool, you know, it's monster, it's got all these weird different teeth and three eyes. Speaking of G.I. Joe the movie, a couple more inadvertent or perhaps purposeful references. If Globulus gouges out Megatron's eye, that recalls in the animated movie, Falcon gouging out Globulus's eye.
With a time worm.
Right. If in the page before that, if Megatron says to someone, "I belong to no one," that recalls him saying to Unicron in Transformers the movie, "I belong to nobody," when Unicron says, "You belong to me now." And a couple pages before that, while we're talking about people gouging out people's eyes, Megatron gouges out Prime's eye, which is a reference to, in the Transformers movie, the attack on Autobot City, Megatron saying to Prime, "I'll rip out your optics," while trying to gouge out his eye. And these references, they don't feel like distracting fan service. They feel like sort of lighter references. Like in the first Michael Bay live action Transformers movie, there's this bit where Prime says to Megatron, "One shall stand, one shall fall." And it is totally artificial to the scene and is definitely some dialogue they added later because it was like the winner of a contest. And like, you don't even see him say it in close up. He's like in silhouette far away and like running or something. And that was dumb and distracting. And these references here in this comic book are not distracting. They do put me in mind of similar things we've seen before. But I also feel like there's an organic quality to them. Like, if you're a Daniel Warren Johnson and you're going to have really savage robot fighting, eventually someone's going to gouge someone's eye out. And it doesn't have to be like recreating a moment from a previous Transformers story.
Okay. So I think overall, this story, as you'd expect from Ryan Ottley, it looks great because he is a superb artist and really gets comics and really gets action within comics. So really enjoyable from that perspective. Really enjoyable page turn shocker of seeing Cobra Law once again. And I don't know that necessarily advances the Cobra story overall, but it's good to kind of see how that Megatron story kind of advances and what that means for Cobra Law. So it's definitely, when we return to Cobra Law next, Megatron is no longer going to be there. So that will be obviously an interesting change and dynamic. Final thoughts on this particular storyline?
I just love the reds that Annalisa Leone is using on Cliffjumper, on Prime, on those wires dangling out of Megatron's armpits, his elbows. Love those. I'll say one last thing. One of the pages you haven't shown where Starscream actually shoots Megatron. And we see on the final panel of that page, the arc on the left and Earth in the middle and on the right, and a very small Megatron silhouette falling down towards Earth. Great. Sense of scale. It's great.
Yeah. Very good. So just to sort of see this one out, let's touch briefly on the final story in the issue, which is the Void Rivals story brought to us by Robert Kirkman as the writer and artist Lorenzo De Felici, colorist Mateus Lopes, and I believe that's the Void Rivals standard crew.
Yes.
Very much feeling like a Void Rivals story. Obviously, we're sort of short focus in on a couple of these side characters, and I guess the obvious sort of page turn reveal shocker moment is having Hot Rod for, and presumably for Transformers fans, that's a big moment. It didn't seem quite as explosive or as revelatory as the other stories.
You know why? Partly why is I think the cover to Void Rivals in a month or two is just a drawing of Springer, the Autobot, the another 1986 Autobot like Hot Rod. Mm-hmm. I think there's an upcoming Void Rivals cover that's just Springer and not the Void Rivals characters. And so, looking ahead in a catalog or ordering the comics, I thought, oh, okay, they're bringing in more season 3/1986 characters. So when I turned the page, a little part of me said, Hot Rod. And a little part of me said, well, yeah, Hot Rod. So there's a tiny change here in the cartoon. Slizardo in the cartoon is only in one episode, and he has this sort of musical mumble. He doesn't speak words. He just sort of has this like higher pitched grumble, like.
You insolent organics.
And so there's an attempt here with the Skuxoid to have him speak in a way that we, the readers, can read his word balloons, which is like, you know, a change from that one episode in 1986 where he talks a particular way. But we haven't seen him so many times since then, basically zero, that this is like a betrayal of, you know, how the character works. Yeah, it's funny because technically this is a Void Rival story, this seven pager, but the only three characters who show up are Transformers characters. So the young man and the young woman from different sides of a war who are the stars of Void Rivals, and the bounty hunter or the like enforcer who the like evil king has sent to get them in, I think, issue 7, 8, the most recent issue of Void Rivals. None of those characters are here. So yes, technically the table of contents calls this Void Rivals story a Void Rivals story. But if you squint, it's just a Transformer story.
Hmm.
There's a Transformer and a Transformers alien and a Transformers alien.
Yeah, although these other aliens have been probably used more times in Void Rivals than they've ever seen the appearance of anywhere else by this point.
Yeah, I think. All right, so
it's the Void Rivals corner of the Energon universe, even if they're not Void Rivals originated characters per se. Although there is the very, very, very final panel, there is a robotic looking creature that says,
right.
It is as you suspected, my lord, which I guess is a robot working for one of the Void Rivals factions.
Yeah. I thought this little story in the middle was neat, pushes things forward. I assume it'll get collected in the Volume 2 Void Rivals collection. I was wondering while reading the G.I. Joe Baroness Duke story where that would end up getting collected. Because I don't know if it would be at the end of the Duke. Anyway, doesn't matter. We'll find out.
We'll find out. Maybe in the deluxe year one G.I. Joe graphic novel that will collect Duke. and Cobra Commander with this in the middle than Destro and Scarlet, perhaps, would be my guess, but we will see.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a prologue to an eventual G.I. Joe
book. Yeah.
When that, or both.
The one that Jason Howard is not drawing.
Cool. So I think we'll leave it there with Void, with the Energon Universe 2024 special team. Let's wrap up. And next time on Talking Joe Energon Universe, we will be talking Cobra Commander with the concluding issue, issue 5, which is out on the 15th of May. Hopefully we will be talking to the artist Andrea Milana as well. The Energon Universe will continue with Destro and Scarlet before too very long, and we will also be covering the latest issues of G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, as they come out. The next issue is 15th of May as well. So all of that and more as the Skybound era of G.I. Joe continues. Yes, on Talking Joe. You can find us at talkingjoe.co.uk. That is our website that will point you in the directions of all of the places you can find us, like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and more. We are also on Patreon at patreon.com/talkingjoe. So a big thanks to all of our backers: Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, Shane, Ryan, Simon, and Chris, who are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. Tim, what about you? Where can people find you when you are not talking to me about G.I. Joe?
Video essays at youtube.com at AtomicAbe. That comic book store I mentioned, and I write about G.I. Joe at my blog, arealamericanbook.com.
Excellent stuff. So all of that said and done, I think we are done. But remember that...
Nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast!
Fantastic. Laters!